Coming up on Philosophy Talk, postmodernism,
fragmented narrative perspectives,
the social construction of reality,
the map replacing the territory,
the self is a relation to the other.
Does postmodernism mean anything at all?
Deconstruction.
Critique of institutional power structures.
Non-representational epistemology. Postmodernism, a movement, doctrine, or intellectual style. Postmodern art.
Jackson Pollock.
Postmodern novels.
Finnegan's Wake.
Postmodern philosophy.
Derrida, Foucault. What does the modern in postmodern mean anyway?
Are we now in the post-postmodern era?
Our guest is Gary Aylesworth.
Postmodernism, coming up on Philosophy Talk after the news. Hello, and welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, postmodernism. We'll start out our show by trying to decide what postmodern is and where it came from. It's an amalgam of different doctrines and movements and art, literature, and philosophy, all kinds of views that don't necessarily agree with one another. So what is it, and how did it get started?
Now, once we clear that up, we'll look at some of the basic ideas of postmodernism, particularly in philosophy. There's a lot of ideas in postmodernism, even if they don't all add up to one coherent meta-narrative or philosophy.
Then, in the third segment of our program, we'll apply what we've learned to contemporary culture. Do we live in a modern culture or a postmodern culture? What's modern? What's postmodern? Stick with us, and we'll, as we try to figure that out. So, John, what do you understand by the term postmodernism?
Well, I'd like to say it's like pornography, although I can't define it. I know it when I see it. But actually, I don't know it when I see it. I know that Finnegan's Wake is postmodern. Austin's Emma, modern. I know that Derrida, postmodern. Hegel, not. But Woody Allen, Wittgenstein, I don't know. I don't really trust my own judgment about what's postmodern and what's not.
Well, let's forget about the examples. Kant said examples are the go-kart of judgment, but forget about the examples. Give me the essence. Be a philosopher. Define it. What's the essence of postmodernism?
Well, I can give you a sort of non-postmodern account of postmodernism. The central theme of postmodernism is quit looking for central themes. Here's one way to look at it. Postmodernism is a reaction to modernism, and modernism refers to a set of views and attitudes that about science and humans and their role in the universe that really comes to us from the Enlightenment, extends through the 19th century, where it absorbs colonialism and industrialization. Think Teddy Roosevelt, think Queen Victoria. That's modernism.
Yeah, but that culminates. Think of where that culminates. Stalin, Hitler, Germany and the Soviet Union, two highly industrialized, highly scientific society. You know, then World War I, World War II, the Depression, it all comes crashing down, all that optimism about human prospect for old guys like you, I mean, that lived through the first half of the 20th century. It must have come as a real eye-opener, all that.
Ah, exactly, and we threw off those modernist ideas and became postmodernists. I remember it well, Ken. Picasso and Wittgenstein and Richard Rorty and I sitting around in a bar in New York with Bertrand Russell and Alfred North Whitehead trying to convince them to quit looking for meta-narrative in this post-World War I and World War II society.
That didn't happen. You're old, but you're not really that old. I was just joking. Come on.
Oh, come on, Ken. You think there's some objective truth about my age? You think I'm just running things together that I experienced and things I only read about? You think there is a single reality, that memory discloses it, that has an epistemologically favored position? I have socially constructed a reality in which I sat around with those guys and talked about it. You think my narrative is either true or false? Ken, you're just disgustingly modern.
I get what you're trying to do. You're trying to illustrate postmodernism. You know, I see your point. By the 1980s, cultural theorists were looking back and saying that there's a lot of the most interesting developments in art, architecture, literature, even philosophy were marked by giving up these themes of modernism, this optimism, this universality. reality, this objectivity, right? And what came instead was marked by pessimism rather than optimism and skepticism about all these absolute values, this universal European Enlightenment stuff, right?
You got it. But as I get it, real postmodernists are not out to replace the modernist meta-narrative or worldview with one of their own. They're out to give up the addiction to meta-narratives. It's kind of the artistic, intellectual, philosophical version of living in the moment.
You know, John, you're kind of a postmodernist guy, aren't you? You're kind of a pessimistic guy, and you're skeptical about just about everything, you know? So you're kind of postmodernist.
Well, you may be confusing my postmodernism for my adult onset attention deficit disorder, but I think you've got a point. I really like postmodernism when it's described. It sounds right on. And I like Finnegan's Wake. I like a lot of postmodern architecture and postmodern novels. On the other hand, I can't abide the music. And when I dig into the philosophy, people like Derrida, I can't really stand it either. I think I'm a Humean postmodernist. I'm skeptical about most things, but not about the difference between good and bad philosophical arguments. Or maybe I'm a semi-postmodernist. Tony Clift defined postmodernism as the theory of rejecting theories. I really like to reject other people's theories. I just don't want to reject my own.
Yeah, well, I get you don't like John Cage's 4 minutes of silence? That's postmodern.
That's the high point of postmodern
yeah.
music.
Well, I think there's something to postmodernism, but I remain deeply deep allegiance to Enlightenment ideals. So I'm a thoroughly modern guy myself, you know.
Poor Ken, mired in modernism.
So look, what's modern? What's postmodern? To help us sort through that, a roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Cornelli, went out and examined some postmodernism and modernism. She files this report.
What exactly is the difference between the modern and the postmodern? Here's a good example. In literature, John Steinbeck is a modern author.
And in the South, he saw the golden oranges hanging on the trees, the little golden oranges on the dark green trees, and guards with shotguns patrolling the lines so a man might not pick an orange for a thin child.
James Joyce is prototypically postmodern.
That the Humpty Hill head of himself promptly sends an unquiring one well to the west in quest of his tumpty tum toes, and their upturned pike point in place is at the knockout in the park, where oranges have been laid to rust upon the green since Devlin's first loved Livy.
Or how about music? B.B. King is modern.
I've been downhearted, babe. Ever since the day we met.
Primitive Radio Gods is postmodern. Modern music evokes one image in the context of another. Rather than one single monumental voice telling a story, postmodernism is all about an interaction between different voices and ideas. The Indiana Jones movies, with their clear goals, strict view of good and evil, and straightforward plot progression, are modern.
Dr. Jones? Surely you don't think you can escape from this island.
It depends on how reasonable we're all willing to be. All I want is the girl.
If we refuse,
then your Führer has no prize.
The movie Memento is postmodern.
Well, I guess it can only make you remember the things you want to be true. Like old Jimmy down there.
He's not the right guy.
He was to you. Come on, you got your revenge. Enjoy it while you still remember. What difference does it make whether he was your guy or not?
It makes all the difference.
Why? You're never going to know.
Yes, I will.
No, you won't.
I will. Somehow.
In Memento, it's not clear who's who, or when things happened, or even what exactly did happen. Then, of course, there are TV shows. The Honeymooners is modern.
You men just think that you own this world.
Yeah, but you women get revenge. You marry us.
The Simpsons? Postmodern.
It's time to learn about love.
No need, Mom. We already learned in school.
She's faking it.
I mean romance, not love.
Mom, romance is dead. It was acquired in a hostile takeover by Hallmark and Disney, homogenized, then sold off piece by piece.
In fact, television itself was the hallmark of the modern era.
The following program is brought to you in living color on NBC.
Everybody watched the same thing. In the postmodern era... It's the internet. You can watch whatever you want, interact with it, and even create your own content.
Four.
Philosophy.
Talk, talk, talk.
I'm Zoe Corneli.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
Our guest today is Gary Aylesworth. He's professor of philosophy from Eastern Illinois University, translator of Martin Heidegger's Basic Concepts, as well as many other writings in continental philosophy. Gary, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. Good morning.
Gary, you're a postmodernist, I guess. You write about postmodernism. Great article in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. So, briefly, how did you come to be a postmodernist? I'm assuming you didn't live kind of through World War I and get disillusioned.
No, I'm not quite that old. My students might not believe that, but I'm not. Well, I didn't really plan on getting into this topic when I initially went to graduate school at SUNY Stony Brook. I went out there to study phenomenology, particularly the phenomenology of Husserl and Heidegger. And
That would be modern, Husserl and Heidegger.
Husserl, certainly. Heidegger is
maybe
a contested figure, I would say. But once I was out there, I was exposed to what was going on in late 20th century French philosophy, where a lot of the supposedly postmodern figures come from. And later on, when I was translating things, I was asked to translate a book. It was a book of interviews with French philosophers. The interviewer was a German. And the book had to do with the reception of Heidegger and Nietzsche and French philosophy back in Germany and the critical issues surrounding all of that. And before I knew it, I was being asked to write other things
on
Derrida and so on.
It sounds like you became an expert before you became a devotee. But at any rate, you are an expert. So Ken and I stumbled around a bit trying to get the feel for postmodernism, but you can probably do a much better job giving us the gist of it.
The gist of it. Yeah,
yes.
Well, that's not so easy. In a way, I suppose it is a little bit like those things we say we can't define, but we recognize when we see them. But I would say that it's a kind of a hallmark of the postmodern or postmodernism not to be sure that you know it when you see it. That remains an open question.
Tell me, doing some research for this show, I gather that 1968 in France was a pivotal moment in the coming to be of at least postmodern kind of theory, critical
May
theory.
May 68, right.
Yeah. What's that all about? And why is that a postmodern defining moment?
Well, many of the figures associated with postmodernism were heavily involved in the leftist movement that took to the streets in May of 68 in Paris and almost brought down the French government. And ever since then, there have been ongoing arguments about whether anything really happened there or not. Was this an event, a historical event, or wasn't it? And ever since, there have been arguments in Paris and elsewhere in the world about whether that really was this event, this singular happening in which something new occurred.
Well, take the side that says there's something new did occur. what are they saying did occur, and how is that related to the rise of postmodernism in their minds, whether or not they're right or wrong?
Well, certainly in Paris, the figures that I'm thinking of, they like to consider the possibility of a new unforeseen event in which a new configuration of social and political arrangements can happen in a rather unforeseen way, something spontaneous, as it were. And those involved in that movement were certainly hopeful that something like that was taking place. One of the frustrating aspects of what was going on for the French government, of course, was that there didn't seem to be any coherent program or set of demands on the part of many of these activists. They would just say things like, well, we just want to be free. That's what will make us happy. Well, what can the government do to satisfy that demand? The answer is probably nothing.
All right, now you in your writings seem to admire this fellow Jean-François Lyotard.
Lyotard, right.
So he puts a lot of emphasis on the on meta-narrative and postmodernism not liking meta-narrative. Can you tell us what a meta-narrative is why you don't like it?
First, I should say that Lyotard is credited with bringing the term postmodern and postmodernism into philosophical discourse in his book, The Postmodern Condition. So you can blame him or you can thank him for that, depending on your point of view. It was a term that was around before, of course, in other areas like architecture and art and literature. His point there is that, as far as he's concerned, the modern, and he doesn't necessarily mean what we usually mean by modern in the historical sense, the modern for him is a structure. It's an epistemological structure in which, say, science or political theory is supposed to be grounded or legitimated by an overarching theory, an epistemology or a metaphysics, if you will. And his point is that in the postmodern world, where knowledge actually becomes information and scientific research, as well as decision-making at the sociological and political level, they're all mediated by digital technology.
Gary, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought, and we're going to dig into it more fully after break, okay? You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're discussing postmodernism with Gary Aylesworth from Eastern Illinois University.
We've been getting a feel for what postmodernism is and what its origins were. We're going to continue with that and then dig into postmodern ideas, especially in philosophy. But why don't you give us your ideas about postmodernism in any field? Art, architecture, literature, philosophy. What's your favorite or least favorite postmodern work and why? Join us by calling us toll-free 1-800-525-9917. To repeat, 1-800-525-9917.
Postmodernism in our everyday life, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Frank Lloyd Wright was a modernist architect. Today on Philosophy Talk, we're looking at postmodernism. I invite all of you postmodernists, anti-postmodernists, modernists, whatever you are, give us a call. Give us a call or an email about what you don't like or what you do like in postmodernism. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Tell us your thoughts, the toll-free number, 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or, as always, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Gary Aylesworth from Eastern Illinois University. We're having a very postmodern conversation. Upbeat, lighthearted, living in the intellectual moment.
So, Gary, look, I'm standing with you in a bar, right, or a cocktail party, and I know you're an expert on postmodernism, and I just want you to give me the takeaway message, right? I don't want a lot of huge discourse, right, because I'm just with you at a cocktail party. What's the takeaway message? What's the cocktail party version of the main idea of postmodernism?
Well, I would tell you there probably isn't any main idea per se, but one of the common themes would be what we might call contextualism, this notion that artworks, novels, pieces of music, or philosophical theories don't just stand on their own. They're part of a larger context, and they wouldn't be the things that they are without that context.
That sounds like a banality so far. I mean, why is that? Why should I be struck by that? I mean, did modernists say, oh, you don't care about the context? I mean, why is that not just a banality?
Well, certainly when it comes to certain types of modern art, it's not a banality, because in modern art, the idea was to become pure, to achieve a kind of formal purity in a painting or in a novel or even in a building, in which the building, the painting, the novel would master its own sense, its own meaning within itself and not have to refer to anything outside of itself.
Oh, okay, now that's helpful, because the one place I kind of get a feel for postmodernism is architecture, and I really think, I guess, modern architecture sucks. If that's what we got in you know, the Bauhaus and the big windowed buildings, but really new stuff I really like, and I guess it's postmodern. And you're saying it's more contextual; it doesn't try to be pure. Is postmodernism intrinsically eclectic, borrowing stuff from different styles?
Well, I think the better examples of postmodern architecture would be more than just eclectic, because there would still be some kind of stylistic statement being made. But what's going on there is the awareness that a building isn't just a building. It's also a cultural signifier. And buildings take on a certain function as a cultural signifier that is above and beyond what the architect may have wanted.
Explain cultural signifier. I know what cultural is, and I know what signifier is. What do they mean together?
Right. Well, a signifier is a sign, say, that functions only in the context of other signs, and they have certain structural relationships with one another, and those relationships are, as we say in structuralist theory, they are arbitrary, which is to say they're instituted in some way. They are conventional. An example of how this happened to modern architecture would be, say, the modern building designed by Mies van der Rohe in New York, the Seagram building, which is the typical glass box, which became emblematic of the other glass boxes that got built around it. And van der Rohe had in mind a kind of architectural purity in that building, which indeed is there, but what he didn't foresee is that that building would become a signifier for global capitalism, something that he himself was not happy with.
Oh, so let's see if I got what you're saying here. So when I design a building and put it in a place and give it a function and a context, I'm not just like designing a building. I'm expressing something about, you know, my place in the world, my place in a culture, my place in a society. And the postmodernists, is it that the postmodernists are much more self-conscious about those self-presentations than the modernists? Is that
I would
one?
Say yes, and they're conscious of the fact that buildings can't simply contain their own context, that the context that surrounds them is something that they themselves can't particularly control with the design of their building. They are aware that buildings are also signifiers.
Now, I think Las Vegas is supposed to be very postmodern. I think there's a book about that. Of course, I can't remember the author.
Yeah, Learning from Las Vegas.
Oh, right. Learning from Las Vegas. Now, I would have thought that in Las Vegas, none of those buildings pays any attention to its context. One of them is supposed to look like Paris. The other one looks... I mean, what's going on there?
Well, that's the point. They are simulacra. The Eiffel Tower is there, but it's not really the Eiffel Tower. The tower, the Taj Mahal is there. It's not really the Taj Mahal. And somebody with a postmodern sensibility would look at all this and say, well, this shows that there's kind of a playfulness, an irony going on here, where we realize we live in a kind of virtual world.
Yeah. So, like, the contextualization there is, like, knowing...
Nothing.
That it's decontextualized in a certain way, that it's just that it's a mere simulacrum, as it were. I don't know if I should say mere, because isn't everything supposed to be a simulacrum?
And the money you lose in Las Vegas is real, Ken.
Yeah, what do you think about that thought of mine, Gary?
Well, not everybody I'm likely to talk about under this topic of postmodernism would talk about the simulacrum. Many do. It's the idea that we are surrounded by virtual images and by messages that are mediated by this network of global communication and teletechnology, and that our perceptions of the world are shaped by these images and by these messages. But the interesting thing is they have already been pre-shaped in some way by the mechanisms of the system itself.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about postmodernism in art, architecture, literature, philosophy. We'd like you to join our discussion, 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917, or send us comments at philosophytalk.org. And Rash in Mountain View is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Rash.
Hello. I found your conversation very enlightening about many aspects of postmodernism, such as philosophy itself. But I have a comment about architecture, and I find a lot of postmodern architecture an aesthetic assault and visually hideous. And I really prefer and like classical architecture and modern architecture especially. I really like streamlined modern and Art Deco. And I find a lot of postmodern stuff just a hodgepodge and eclectic mishmash of stuff. Although there are examples I like, such as the AT&T building in New York City, the Chippendale building. I think that's a good idea. but a lot of the other stuff I don't like.
Well, what do you like about the Chippendale Building particularly?
Just the, like what you've been saying, I think, the statement, how it's ironic, mm-hmm. but it's still good-looking, whereas a lot of postmodern buildings I see are definitely not good-looking.
So I mean, how can a building be ironic? Explain that to me.
Well, that's a good point. I'm not sure I can. You guys are using a lot of jargon that I don't know.
You don't like postmodern architecture, it sounds to me like you have a postmodern sensibility because you can look at a building and say it's ironic.
That's definitely true. I'm a modern guy, born in the 50s. Mm-hmm. I have postmodern sensibilities. But just as far as architecture goes, I don't like it. There's postmodern music and many other aspects. I think that's great.
Uh-huh.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call, Rash. It was not a very rash call. It was a thought-out call. So Gary, what's your thoughts about anything that Rash had to say?
Yeah, the building he's talking about is the AT&T building that was designed by Philip Johnson and caused a big stir when it was built in 1984 because of that Chippendale decoration at the top. It's a glass tower, a skyscraper, but it has a pitched roof with a round cutout in the center. So it looks like the back of a Chippendale chair, or it has the silhouette of a 18th century grandfather clock. And it caused a big stir at the time because it disrupted the modernist purity of central Manhattan, and a lot of people were unhappy with it. But yes, it was a gesture, an ironic gesture on Johnson's part.
Gary, let me ask you a question. So postmodernist architecture, you talked about how it's contextualized and self-conscious of itself as a self-presentation kind of thing, and there's postmodernist literature and postmodernist art and postmodernist philosophy. Do these things really have much deep to do with each other? I mean, is there some unity there or not?
That's really hard to say. Those who are in the business of theorizing about it often appeal to something like Kant's aesthetic judgment, where you have a plurality of intuitions without an identifiable concept to give them unity, and somehow you simply have to make a judgment. So, and I think the field of things we could talk about under this topic of postmodern would be a lot like that.
Here's a thoughtful email from Dan in El Cerrito. He says, "My favorite postmodern work is Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon, for a specific reason. The problem with postmodernism, as usually promoted, is that the baby accompanies the bathwater. It's a great service to humanity that faith in meta-narratives has been eroded. We are less lemmings, I like to think, than they were before. But it's a big leap from that to saying that all narratives are suspect to saying that there are no narratives in which we can put a certain amount of faith. I like Gravity's Rainbow because it unashamedly places faith in the basic human impulses like friendship and the not uncomplicated impulse to be helpful and kind."
Oh, that's a mouthful.
Yes. Well,
what do you think, though, Gary?
Well, postmodernism doesn't mean there's no narrative.
Uh-huh.
Narrative is still around us everywhere, and it's evidently indispensable, but there are many narratives, and there's no one narrative to give unity to all the narratives.
So Gary, that leads us back to philosophy. It looks to me like there's a big problem for postmodernist philosophy. The spirit of postmodernism is minimal meta-narrative, contextualism, don't worry about unifying themes. Philosophy's business is to find unifying themes and construct meta-narratives. The idea of a postmodernist mm-hmm. philosopher sounds like a contradiction.
Well, philosophy as practiced in certain ways is all about those things you just described, but philosophy has always been about pushing its own limits, too, and remaining open as to what philosophy really is or what it really isn't.
Well, you could say that a swimmer pushes his own limits when he dives into an empty pool. But it's still not a very good idea. I mean, how's it going to work?
But the idea of postmodern philosophy, I take it, is that many philosophical ambitions that we inherit from our modern forebears just should be abandoned. They can't be satisfied. And that's a philosophical move to say foundationalist epistemology and realist metaphysics and all this stuff about objective value, all this search for this, it just should be abandoned.
Then the two of you can answer me this question. Why is A.J. Ayer not a postmodernist? Why is Rudolf Carnap not a postmodernist? Mm-hmm. Because they give up all those projects.
What do you think, Gary?
Well,
because they're not French.
I'm not well-versed in those areas. I've read Carnap and I've read Ayer. From a sort of postmodern view. I guess I would say that one of the hallmarks of classically modern philosophy is this search for a kind of formal identity between a reality that's out there and our knowledge of it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that is challenged by these other ways of thinking that we group under postmodernism is precisely this notion of a formal identity between our thoughts and our statements about the world and the actual states of affairs themselves.
So you might say Carnap and Eyre, they have some postmodern things in them. They don't give up this epistemology that really respects science and thinks that that scientific thinking is
And they're still operating within a kind of representationalist tradition.
Right. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or send us email at comments@philosophytalk.org. And Irene in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Irene.
Hi, thank you for answering my question. The Reverend Jim Wallace, who wrote Why the Right is Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It, gave a speech at the Network of Spiritual Progressives founding conference where he said that to not see evil in the acts of 9/11 is to be suffering from a postmodern relativism. Is he understanding postmodern right, or?
Thanks, Irene. Excellent question. Postmodernism is often accused of this kind of thing. Gary, what do you think?
No, I don't think that it's relativism. I don't think it's moral relativism. I don't know anybody who didn't see evil in 9/11, for example.
The perpetrators? Osama bin Laden?
Well, there's nobody.
Islamic fundamentalists?
Nobody associated with postmodernism would say that there's no evil there. There are some that this was not a crime. This was not an act of murder. I don't know anybody who has said or would say such a thing.
Yeah, but we don't want to sell postmodernism short. I mean, I think there's some very interesting things that have come out about, you know, why, what's the difference between terrorism as done by Al-Qaeda and terrorism in World War II?
Yeah.
So I mean, I think in this case, postmodernists, people that are recognizably postmodernist, including this poor guy that got fired at the University of Colorado, have had interesting and insightful things to say.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I'm going to actually, after the break, I'm going to challenge you a little bit. Tell me how the postmodernists can get away with saying that Osama bin Laden is evil if they question these absolutes. Right? You're going to have to tell me how that exactly works. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing postmodernism with Gary Aylesworth from Eastern Illinois University.
We've talked about how postmodernism arose, what the basic ideas are, begin to talk about how philosophy accommodates itself to this lack of meta-narrative. In the next segment, we're going to try to get a better feel for postmodern in today's culture. We'll try to overcome my inability to say what's postmodern and what's not. Rock and roll, Fox News, MTV, the Internet, George Bush, Jon Stewart. Tell us what you think is postmodern and what's not, why you like it, and why.
At 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. It's a postmodern world when Philosophy Talk continues.
How do you feel about postmodernism? Do we live in a postmodern culture? Is California the real first postmodern society? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Gary Aylesworth from Eastern Illinois University. Gary, I want to challenge you a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You said rightly that nobody in the postmodern movement said that the guys who did 9/11 weren't evil. I grant you that. But how can they, without appealing to fixed absolutes, you know, universal values, mm-hmm. if you grant, you know, if you think about Foucault and all this dialectic of power and all that stuff, How can they say with a straight face that that was pure evil?
Well, nothing's pure, of course, so I don't know that we would want to characterize it that way. It's the idea, in fact, that the demand for purity leads to these acts, right? One of the ideological features of the terrorists is that they have this notion of purity that they think is being violated.
Yeah, but isn't the same true of of official American doctrine. There's an axis of
Absolutely.
Evil. We're on the right side. They're
Absolutely.
On the wrong side.
Absolutely.
So that doesn't mark a difference between the terrorists killing and our killing, does it?
I mean, isn't it just that, you know, we kind of are in solidarity with each other, and they killed a bunch of people with whom we stand in solidarity, and we're not in solidarity with them, and when we're not in solidarity and they do bad things we don't like, we say, you know, yuck, mm-hmm. boo. Isn't that all there is to it? But they could say that equally back to us. Tell me in a postmodern way right. how I condemn them as evil. I just...
Well, I guess the postmodernists can say it's as true that they're evil as it's true that New York is in New York State. They're both kind of partly cultural constructions, but there's a lot of agreement on this.
This is why I'm saying I don't think what we're talking about here is relativism in this sense, because I think there are concerns within postmodern thinking for the other and for allowing the other to be other and not presuming to characterize them in a particular way or to vilify them and so forth. And so if we seem a bit hesitant to go along with George Bush and simply refer to them as the evildoers, as those who are other, and to dehumanize them in that way and so forth, we're kind of missing something important.
So the way I might put it is the postmodernists don't deny that what Al-Qaeda did was evil, but they maybe help us understand that a lot of what we do is equally
right.
evil let's, or maybe less evil but still evil. Here's a quick email, a little change of pace. There was a great passage in the Jane Austen Book Club, it said in Davis, California, to the effect that I wasn't going to think about postmodernism. There are people over at the university paid to do that. Well, so has postmodernism really made it into culture, or is it just kind of an upper level academic preoccupation?
Elitist, you know.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Whose popular surface is only on Philosophy Talk and a few other places.
Well, I suppose theorizing about it is still something that you don't see too often outside of the universities and the think tanks. But we experience it all around us all the time. It's in popular culture. You pointed out it's in music, it's in film, and it's in our everyday experience of things like globalization.
Okay, well, let's expand on that, but let's let some callers in here. 1-800-525-9917. Martin in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Martin.
Hi, is this me?
Yeah.
Okay, I have a point of view and a question I want to bring up. The way I see it, the postmodernism, is that it's almost like a cultural melting pot and a musical, a philosophical, whatever. You know, any almost like if anything goes, as long as it's legal, anything goes, anytime, anywhere. And that brings me to a question. Is this, a rhetorical question, is this good for humanity? Is this good for arts, music, philosophy? Is this good for us as a bright human race for the future? Or is it bad? Oh. Does it lead to some kind of cultural abyss eventually?
Martin, excellent question. Look, the postmodernism purported to be an emancipatory movement, Gary. I mean, people were going to be set free and reason was going to govern and all these institutions were going to have a rational basis. And the postmodernists think that modernism didn't live up to that promise and couldn't because it had contradictions within itself about this stuff, right? And there were all these hegemonies of gender and race and class.
Right.
Does postmodernism inherit the liberation mantle of, you know?
Yes,
what?
It does. It does. But there's a notion called the dialectic of enlightenment. And this notion goes something like this, that political and social liberation were supposed to be synonymous with the development of science and technology. But what has happened is that the very methods that were so successful in developing modern science and technology and giving us control over the world became implements of political oppression when used to manage and govern society.
So I just want to interject a little postmodern moment here. The first thing Martin said is this me? Isn't that a great sentence? Is this Me, I think Derrida would love that sentence. I mean, why would you ask? What's the situation in which you can say, is this me? You have to be kind of alienated from yourself. You can imagine somebody at a really big orgy looking at a foot and saying, is this me?
Well, there you go. But that's a deep and important thing about postmodern, the very self, mm-hmm. right? I mean, Foucault, and something I read about Foucault, compares Descartes asking, who am I? Right, and the answer is supposed to be this universalist kind of thing. Once and for all, we can answer who I am. And Kant asking, what is enlightenment? Right, at the moment that enlightenment was happening, he's sort of what are we now kind of thing. And so the very self is kind of historicized and contingent and all this stuff. But I still want to know about the liberation part of postmodernism. How's it supposed to be a liberating movement?
Well, it's liberating in the sense that these questions are supposed to be kept open, that we need to realize that any attempt to attain some kind of self-identity will be necessarily incomplete and will always be articulated in some kind of an idiom and must be articulated in some kind of an idiom, but we won't ever be able to say once and for all, well, this is who I am.
But here's my worry about this. The Cartesian self, which stands outside of history, right, and culture, and is this thing fixed and inviolable. Whenever there are these social structures thrown on it, it can say, "The heck with those things."
Yeah,
that doesn't do justice to what I really am. But
right.
The postmodern self is just this kind of cultural construction constructed in the moment.
But
there's
not
no
just
kind
that.
Of transcendent self.
Yeah, but no, not just that. There's always this sort of. Moment, if you will, what some of the people we're talking about would call the event, the spontaneity that does free us up from that very context that at the same time we can't separate ourselves from.
So that leads to the question, Sartre, postmodern or modern?
Modern.
But he's the spontaneity, create your own self, all this stuff, but still modern, huh? Just because his books are so long?
Modern, well, particularly in the sort of classical Sartre of the 30s and 40s, mm-hmm. where he talks about consciousness as being sui generis and mm-hmm. not being connected ontologically, if you will, to its position in the world, but always mm-hmm. Above and beyond it. But his notion of what is free in consciousness, again, is a kind of a notion of purity, and that's where we're going to get a divergence somebody like Foucault or Derrida.
Let's focus on that a little bit. We don't have much time, but I want to see if you can clear that up for me. Some people think that the postmodernists kind of throw out the baby with the bathwater, and really, you know, because they lose this spontaneity, this freedom, this self that's out, how did you put it? Above and beyond, right? Mm-hmm. And for Kant and Sartre, the above and beyond self was the guardian of freedom and autonomy and all that stuff and the possibility of self-creation. But isn't that lost in the postmodernist approach?
It's not lost, but it is part of an ironic sort of double gesture in which we know that freedom isn't that freedom apart from the very situation that we are in.
Yeah.
And so that, yes, we are free and spontaneous on the one hand, but we are never free and spontaneous in this pure metaphysical sense. We're free and spontaneous in a kind of performative sense in terms of what we do in the situation that we're in.
Well, and kind of my final verdict on postmodernism, at least for this program, is, I agree with the critique of rationality with a big R, truth with a big T, reality with a big R, all this purity and stuff. But what postmodernism seems to give us in its place is only in a kind of ironic reality, a very unrobust sense of reality, of truth in the self. And frankly, it ain't enough for me.
Yeah, well, Gary, on John's dissatisfaction, I got to thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you, gentlemen. It was a pleasure.
Our guest has been Gary Aylesworth. He's professor of philosophy from Eastern Illinois University, translator of Martin Heidegger's Basic Concepts, as well as many other writings in continental philosophy. So, John, what did you learn about postmodernism today? I see you wrote a nice blog about that.
Yes, I wrote a blog about postmodernism, explaining why I like the sentences that postmodernists write and some of their paragraphs, but I'm never able to read through a whole essay. I would sum it up this way. Can a philosopher without a meta-narrative is like a fish without a hook in its mouth? It's maybe doing a lot of swimming around, but there ain't there much to eat.
Well, I don't know. You know, that part of postmodernism, I actually kind of like it. I actually think of all these grand narratives. You know, the Marxist grand narrative of history, Hegelian narrative of history, all this. You know what I think all that stuff was? It was a stand-in for divine providence. Mm-hmm. That history has a story to tell, that's a working out of rationality and a coming to fruition of universal reason and all that stuff. And I think that's all a bunch of hooey, to tell you the truth. And I agree with the postmodernist about that. I really do. So, look at all the damage that has been done under these totalizing fantasies.
Yeah. Right? And is still being done under the totalizing fantasy. I think you and I agree with being more drawn to the negative parts of postmodernism than to its positive, in spite of its best efforts, meta-narrative about what's going on.
Well, right, and I agree about that. I think it has maybe thrown out too much of the baby with the bathwater. You know, I think it's a little tricky, because you get rid of the meta-narratives, the totalizing narratives about human history, and how do people live? Well, live in the moment, construct yourself. Well, how? But then it even denies freedom, you know? And so I've
been reading a lot of postmodernism, at least by my standards, this last week, and these guys don't live in the moment. They're always trying to bring in Marx or Kant or somebody else out of the moment.
So for the final word on postmodernism, we turn to the most postmodern radio voice we know. That's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, if you are a thinking person, postmodernism may have affected the way you speak. To paraphrase Professor Harold Hill, do certain words start to creep into your vocabulary? Words like paradigm, deconstruction, marginalized, transgression, dialectic, gaze. Much fun has been had at postmodernism's jargon-crammed expense, but what is it? Postmodernism places an emphasis on how perception takes place rather than what is perceived. It blurs distinctions between genres so that Popeye the Sailor Man, say, can be as worthy of study as Ulysses the Sailor Man. It is relentlessly relative. My personal encounters with POMO people, whenever I'd ask a question of one, he or she, instead of answering, would examine the cultural assumptions that led to my asking it. To indicate how deeply POMO permeates the culture, or at least some cultures, just last year, I read a newspaper report covering a discussion in San Francisco about whether to weed out invasive plants from the parks. One participant accused the gardeners of xenophobia and racism. That's right, plant racism. What about POMO and science? Some postmodernists claim that human subjectivity precludes the objectivity of science. Since objectivity does not exist, science therefore subverts the oppressed. One French theorist even wondered if E equals MC squared was a sexed equation. It privileges the speed of light over other speeds because it goes the fastest. If I understand the logic of that, the speed of light is oppressing the speed of sound. The sun is committing a hate crime. It was exactly this sort of thing that got to physicist Alan Sokol back in the mid-90s. He wrote an essay called Transgressing the Boundaries Towards a Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity, which was accepted and published in the journal Social Text. In the essay, Sokol called for a liberatory postmodern science and emancipatory mathematics. No sooner had the article appeared than Sokol revealed it to be a hoax, leading to much anger from POMO people. One of the editors of Social Text speculated that, quote, Sokol's parody was nothing of the sort, and that his admission represented a change of heart or a folding of his intellectual resolve, unquote. Another reader responded, quote, what Sokol's hoax reveals is his anxiety as a scientist about this empire of knowledge, as well as a rather ignorant and condescending relation to complicated philosophical, sociological, and theoretical positions, unquote. So, once again, the postmodern position is pretty much unassailable. If you point out that the emperor has no clothes, POMO people will launch into a cultural history of clothing, the hermeneutics of the representations of nudity, and the role of hegemony in the perception of emperors. Bless their hearts. Of course, by hearts, I mean the metaphorical trope defined by the patriarchy. I gotta go.
Ian Scholes, the only man who can solve a philosophical problem in 60 seconds.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2007.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks go to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Zoe Corneli, and Mark Stone.
Philosophy Talk is sponsored in part by Powell's City of Books.
On the web at powells.com.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and the members of KALW Local Public Radio Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.